Support for WGTD and the morning show comes from Jack Andrea, featuring unique shopping and the historic Jack's Cafe, featuring an eclectic menu. A Kenosha tradition since 1911, modernized for a new age. Visit jackandrea.com for more information. The morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have three author interviews for you today, and here's part one. Words can scarcely convey how honored I am to be speaking for the next few minutes with Ingrid Newkirk. She is the founder of PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, which is the largest and most influential animal rights organization in the world. She has written a number of different books and has just now co-written a brilliant and fascinating new book called Animal Kind: Remarkable Discoveries About Animals and Revolutionary New Ways to Show Them Compassion. This is a book which, first of all, shines a light on the remarkable capacity of many animals to communicate with one another, to demonstrate and receive compassion. The migration of many animals that demonstrates extraordinary skills and instincts, and then goes on to talk about some of the ways in which we can perhaps treat animals much more wisely and compassionately. It's an important book co-authored by Gene Stone, and it is published by Simon & Schuster. Again, it's titled Animal Kind. Ingrid Newkirk, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
Ahead of us talking about your book, I hope you won't mind if we take just a couple of minutes to talk about what prompted you back in 1980 to found this group known as PETA, which is very much still alive and well 40 years later. Take us back to 1980 and to what the primary concerns were that caused you to create this organization.
Well, that's easy. I was a law enforcement officer, and in the course of my duties, I found all sorts of things that I wasn't expecting. I had grown up caring about animals. I've always been an animal lover, if you will. But I didn't know a lot of things, and as a deputy sheriff, I found animals who were abandoned on a farm, and this little pig who I picked up, who was basically dying of starvation, took him out to a water pump, gave him a drink of water, and he was the catalyst for my becoming vegetarian, because on my way home that evening, I was really hungry. It was before the days of microwave ovens, and I thought, I wonder what I've got to eat for dinner, and I thought, oh, good. I defrosted those pork chops, and suddenly I put two and two together, and I thought, I'm about to prosecute somebody for what they've done to this little pig, but I'm going home, and I'm going to eat the body parts of a little pig who could not have died well in a slaughterhouse. I hadn't seen one then. I hadn't been inside one, but we all know. I mean, it's not a place you take the family for a picnic. So I thought, well, I'm not going to eat animals anymore. And as time went on, I actually saw inside laboratories. I went to the National Institutes of Health biggest laboratory in Poolesville, Maryland, and I found disgusting things that were just because of negligence to the animals there, a disrespect for them, a failure to appreciate the smallest things they needed and the biggest things they needed. And I thought, this is not what I thought animal research was like. I thought it was just a few animals being treated well to cure diseases. This is nothing like that. So it occurred to me, if I, as a person who cared about animals, didn't know these things, there must be a lot of other people who might appreciate having their eyes opened and not just seeing how bad things are for animals, but also, if I did the homework for them, PETA could show them the different things they could do that would make a difference.
When it came time to create this organization, did you have any notion whatsoever of how large and how significant and influential it would become?
No, none whatsoever. I mean, back then we didn't have the internet, so you couldn't reach people just in a flash as you can now. Today we have millions of views, you know, in just a matter of minutes. But then you had to hand print a flyer and go out on the street and hand it to people. And I remember there was President Reagan's inauguration, and we went out with a huge banner that was all about why nobody should wear mink coats. And they were all the rage then. All those little girls like me had grown up wanting a mink coat. And it was read out loud on national television. And people, for the first time, thought, what's that about? Because we didn't have access to the information then about how animals were treated for fur. And people started to write. And then we did an investigation in a laboratory in Silver Spring, and it was the first ever search warrant served by the police to take animals out of a laboratory. And that made the front page of the Washington Post, and stories went around the world, and suddenly we had struck a nerve, and people were saying those magical words, how can I help? How can I help? And we certainly told them how they could help.
One last question. PETA is a presence really around the world. How big a difference is there from, in a sense, culture to culture, from country to country, in terms of the way in which these kind of issues and concerns are received and appreciated and acted upon?
Well, I think people are people all over the world, and there are people who are kind and caring and people who are callous or uncaring. But each culture poses its challenges, that's for sure. We work in India to try to end the use of elephants in these awful rides. Most of them are lame. They take tourists up into the Red Fort and into Jaipur and places like that. And we have temple elephants as well. That's just one facet that we don't have to deal with here. Here, elephants are pretty much gone completely from any circuses or entertainments. We've recognized who they are. India, of course, is better on not eating animals, but they have a huge dairy industry, and the baby cows, the calves, are thrown out onto the street if they're male and left to starve. So that's really awful. But our industry in dairy is similarly bad here. What we do is we use the calves for veal. So everywhere you go, Spain, we have bullfighting. We're working there. But we have 100 towns now that have said no, they don't want to bullfight anymore. But, of course, we don't have to deal with that here. So there's a Canada seal slaughter, and we've all seen what's happening in China with a total lack of respect for animals. No laws whatsoever in that country. So bears are trained for the circus in extremely cruel ways. And, you know, there's a dog meat trade still going on, despite stories that say it may be ending, still going on.
So the work goes on for PETA, and we want to remind people that more information is available at the organization's website, which is PETA.org. And, of course, that's P-E-T-A, PETA.org. I'm honored today to be speaking with the co-founder of PETA, Ingrid Newkirk, who has co-authored a brand-new book called Animal Kind, Remarkable Discoveries About Animals and Revolutionary New Ways to Show Them Compassion. And, of course, this title, Animal Kind, is in a sense intended to, at least in part, to parallel the term humankind. I guess what part of this is you want us to think about all animals in their many and various ways as deserving our respect and appreciation and compassion. Beyond that, what prompted you to put this book together in this way?
Well, you're absolutely right. I'd like us to think of animals, because we are one. If we took biology 101, we know that, as linked, not ranked, because they all have their various forms of intelligence, their various forms of being able to cope in a world that's human-dominated. But what prompted me were two things, really. first the 40th year anniversary of PETA, I thought it would be nice to have a celebratory kind of book, and Animal Kind is that, because the second part is so many people now, much more than when we started, know about animals. They see these fabulous videos on the internet, especially now during this lockdown. They've seen animals emerging from the forest, bears playing with their babies in the park, even goats walking through a village in Wales as if they were having a parade, monkeys diving in Asia into swimming pools in closed hotels, just showing that they're very much like us, that they enjoy life, they want pleasure, they don't want to be locked up and so on. And, you know, we see a lot of videos about our dogs doing naughty things when we're out of the house, pushing that chair against the kitchen cabinet and then getting up onto the counter and taking out what they want and so on. And so I think we've come to appreciate animals more. But there are so many things that people don't know about animals that I wanted to take some of the jaw-dropping bits and pieces about their talents, their empathy, their emotions, and open people's eyes and their hearts to them that way. And then, of course, the second part is now we know who they are, what can we do so that we can show them more consideration?
Mm. You have split the first part of the book into what I think are very sensible sections in which we examine various facets of animal experience. For instance, one of the most interesting chapters, I think, is titled The Channels of Communication, in which you touch on just some of the remarkable ways in which animals communicate with one another in a way that probably a few years ago we had absolutely no idea was even going on. Why don't you share with our listeners just a couple of your favorite examples of remarkable communication between animals?
Certainly. One thing most people don't realize is that when a baby dolphin is born, he's given a whistle name, and that's his name that he'll keep for life. So dolphins each have an individual whistle name, and if a dolphin doesn't hear that whistle, see that dolphin, for up to 20 years, we know that when they hear that whistle, they know exactly who that is. I think that's pretty remarkable. We also know that, and we didn't know this for years, that elephants communicate subsonically. That is, they send a signal, a rumble, under the earth, and it could go 1 or 2 miles to reach other elephants. And they don't just hear it as a rumbling sound. They interpret it. And so they may know, oh, there's a drought here, but those elephants, 1 or 2 miles away, have found a water hole. Or those elephants are warning us there's someone here shooting or rounding up elephants, or baby elephants usually for China and so on. We do know, too, that animals can communicate in the most extraordinary ways. Cows have a very subtle facial language that we have only recently figured out. Rhinos use a breathing language. So the different breaths and the different depths of those breaths that they take are communicating things to other rhinos. And frogs in the city now have to contend with all this human noise. So they actually have figured out how they could get into drain pipes to amplify their croaking and their tapping so that other frogs can hear what they're saying.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Another chapter of your, again, of the first part of your book, Animal Kind, explores the really intriguing question of whether or not animals are capable of love. And you tell us this is a simple question that has weighed on researchers for years. Can you just say a word about how difficult it is to explore and study a question like this?
Well, you know, I think often they're looking in the wrong way for it, because you find awful things done to animals by researchers to try to establish, do they share some trait with us? And all animals certainly love. We see the extraordinary love of a bear for her baby, her cubs. She'll do anything. And this is true of so many animals, which is why I'm heartbroken that last month there was a new law passed in Alaska so that trophy hunters who just want to stick a mother bear's or a cub's head on their wall can now go into the den, into the home of those bears, and blow them away. But yes, there's such love. We have, I think, nowadays over a 45% divorce rate among human beings. But swans, geese, pigeons, they, as I say, they marry their high school sweetheart, and they stay with them for their whole lives unless there's something that comes along to disrupt them. There is actually a webcam for two storks in Croatia in this tiny village. A teacher has set up a nest for one of the storks on the roof of his house. And the reason he does that is because he found the female stork had been shot. And so he nursed her back to health. He winters her over in his house. And then he pops her back on the nest in the spring. And every winter, her mate, who loves her dearly, flies to South Africa, 5,000 miles away, and comes back to this little village and this little rooftop in Croatia the very same day every spring. And the whole village comes out to welcome him home, and then he is with her again, and they raise another brood of storks, and the father teaches the young ones how to fly. But they have enormous love for each other. Pigeons especially are very sensuous. The male and the female both make milk for their babies in their crop under their chin. And so if you see a pigeon with their bill down another pigeon's bill or beak, they could be kissing because they are so sensuous and they do fall in love. Or it could be one of the parents feeding a baby.
In the chapter called The Joy of Play, one sentence really leapt out at me when you write, "Play is ubiquitous in the animal kingdom. It's found in humans and dogs, monkeys, and crocodiles." The thought had never occurred to me that crocodiles play. And of course, if we make that assumption, then we're not even looking for hints of playful behavior among crocodiles. But apparently, crocodiles like us enjoy play.
They do. I mean, crocodiles don't look anything like us. I mean, they've got eyes and a nose and some legs, but that's about it. And it's very easy to dismiss those who really don't look like us at all, and especially if they're scary. And crocodiles and alligators are certainly scary. Just as human beings eat certain other animals, a crocodile or an alligator might just eat you. But that doesn't mean that they don't like to have fun. And in the book, I do talk about a researcher who didn't believe it when he got a call from a wildlife park where they had some crocodiles. And they said, well, this crocodile just loves to play with a ball. We put a beach ball in the water, and he just bounces it around, has great time with it. And this researcher thought, don't think so, went out there, documented it, and said, you know, you're right. And since then, we've had people who've shown that crocodiles like to play with flowers. They will, and I don't know how they do that with that big mouth, but they will take flowers from the embankment and toss them in the air and then play around with them in the water. So, yes, even crocodiles, not just dogs and us, love to have some fun.
Mm. And, by the way, I want to thank you for taking some time to share some wonderful facts that I don't ever remember learning about octopuses, which are, of course, an incredibly fascinating, intelligent creature, and one of those creatures about which there is still some mystery, and that a creature that we are still coming to understand and fully appreciate.
Octopuses are extraordinary. In fact, they belong to the cephalopod family, and all the cephalopods from squids and so on are all just fascinating. And some of them, some of this family, they can actually divide their face in such a way, the messages on their face that they send, so that one side of their face is showing all these different patterns and colors, which might be that they're flirting with another cephalopod, maybe a cuttlefish, or over here, and the other side of their face is showing rage and all this machismo, and that is directed at the male who's on their other side, who doesn't realize they're flirting on the other side of their face. But they can squeeze themselves into the tiniest, tiniest thing, because the only solid piece of an octopus is the beak. They have a beak like a parrot, and that's hard, and they can't really do anything to squish that down. But when you hear about an octopus waiting for everyone to go home in the aquarium at night, and then opening the top of the aquarium and coming out and moving around, putting lights off, going down drainage holes, they can get into any space as long as it's no bigger than their beak.
Incredible. So much to enjoy in the first part of this book. But, of course, the second part of the book is really equally important, in some ways more important, because it is in the section two, that you spell out some ways in which we can be more compassionate towards the animal kingdom. And you title this section, actually, Revolutionary New Ways to Show Them Compassion. Why do you frame this part of the book in this particular way? Why is it important for us to be thinking about our compassion for animals in revolutionary terms?
Well, the reason I use that word is because we're in a wonderful position today that we weren't in when Peter started 40 years ago. I mean, I didn't know what to eat, for example. Nobody even knew the word vegan. They must have thought it was someone from Las Vegas. And today, you go to the grocery store, and people are standing at the plant milk shelves, and it takes them 10 minutes to figure out, well, should I get the macadamia, the soy, the almond, the coconut, you know, vanilla, chocolate? These are revolutionary ideas today that we have. We have every taste alike in food that you could imagine. The other day I was reading that someone has now shrimp that's not real shrimp, but it tastes just like shrimp. You've got the Beyond Burger. You've got all these, you know, chicken nuggets that aren't made of chickens. So you can have clean food. You can have taste alikes. You can have anything to put in a recipe. There's a wealth of vegan cookbooks. When Peter started, there wasn't, I think there was one, and it was a religious cookbook called Ten Talents. So that's revolutionary. Clothing has taken this giant leap. You know, as I say, when I was starting Peter, people wore fur. Today, most people, you can't even find it. All the big designers have said no. The retailers are saying no. Canada Goose is one of the few holdouts that still uses wild-caught coyotes in the collars. But today you've got leather made from pineapple, from grapes, from tea leaves, from cactus, and you may not even realize it unless you look at the label and you see this isn't real leather, it's vegetable leather. And, of course, we've got this resurgence of interest in recyclables or biodegradable things that we didn't even think about back then. So today we have hemp and we have certain cotton things and fibers that can jute, that can break down. Whereas if you throw a pair of leather shoes out of the window, you can come back 20 years later and they'll be still sitting there because they were treated with all these chemicals to stop decomposition. The same is true in laboratories. You know, it always was. If you wanted to know if you were pregnant, you had to kill a rabbit. You sent a urine sample to a lab, and they killed a rabbit. That's all gone. You've got a litmus test you take home in a few minutes, you know. And we have whole organs on a chip, human organs on a chip. Technology has saved us. So it is revolutionary, even entertainment. You have virtual reality. You can dive into the oceans with orcas. You don't have to go to a sea amusement park thing. You can be there right with them, hearing them breathe, swimming with them, and yet you're not there at all.
That actually was the most intriguing section of this part of your book, the section titled Entertainment, just because it, it, it took us into areas that I had not really stopped to think about, and all of the many ways in which we have used animals for our entertainment, and in many cases in ways that were unkind and perhaps even cruel. And just tell our listeners for a moment about the ways in which we are finding ways to entertain ourselves without using animals in the way that was once customary.
I think the worst thing was when we started out going out to explore other countries, the explorers brought back specimens, they would call them, of animals they had never seen before. They'd never seen a giraffe or an elephant or a rhinoceros or certain monkeys. And so these animals were uprooted from their homes, shoved into the cargo holds of ships, and many of them died. Over the years, that mortality rate hasn't actually significantly dropped until we've stopped using animals. So when the animals came back here, they were put in very small cages. No one knew how to look after them, knew their nutritional needs, knew their great loneliness, and had and really deprived them of everything that was important and known and natural to them, for zoos, for circuses, for all these kinds of things. When I was a child, I think kids would run into the street if they saw the circuses come to town. And nowadays, children don't want to see wild, glorious, intelligent, social animals being paraded in this show of domination. So over the years, we've stopped doing that. And today, you can see a National Geographic special. You can play a video game. You can be respectful of animals and know more about who they are. They're not something to stand on a headdress and poke with a bull hook, one of those fireplace poker-like objects they use to control animals in the circus.
Hmm. Your book ends with a very moving afterword in which you include these words: animals need all the friends they can get. How would you have us be friends to animals?
I thank you for that, because I do think that it's a great orchestra of life. We're all in it together, and we need to really think, and that's the first part of the book, who animals are, what makes them tick, and be respectful of their varied abilities and their interests and just being treated fairly and respectfully and certainly not cruelly. So if we're about to buy something, whether it's to eat or to wear or cosmetic, just to clean our floor, if we're about to entertain ourselves, we should think, is there an animal in this equation? And if there is, ask ourselves, were they volunteers? Do you think they enjoy it? Was this taken from them? Did they have to die to produce this? And if the answer is yes to any of those things, leave it on the shelf, choose something else, and let's be the kind of people, animal kind people, that we can be, the kind of people that we tell our children and our grandchildren that we are: decent, kind, respectful, compassionate people.
Hmm. The book again is Animal Kind: Remarkable Discoveries About Animals and Revolutionary New Ways to Show Them Compassion, published by Simon & Schuster, co-written by Gene Stone and my morning show guest, Ingrid Newkirk, the co-founder of PETA. Ingrid Newkirk, thank you so much for all of the important work that you have done over the years, and thank you for giving the world this wonderful new book. Best wishes to you.
Thank you very, very much.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I count among my sweetest pleasures of hosting The Morning Show the conversation that I had some years ago with a brilliant writer by the name of Soman Shenani upon the occasion of the publication of the first book in what has turned into an amazing series called The School for Good and Evil. We are reconnecting with the author now on the eve of the release of the sixth and final book in this series, The School for Good and Evil. And we're going to be talking with Soman Shenani about this wild, wonderful ride which he has been on with these incredible characters, and about the way in which The School for Good and Evil is about to take the screen. Soman Shenani, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
For somebody who does not know about your series or did not hear our first interview of probably 5 or 6, 7 years ago, explain in brief the wonderful scenario of The School for Good and Evil.
So it's kind of like a mashup of the darker edges of Harry Potter and sort of a twisted Disney-esque world where you have this school where fairy tale heroes and villains are trained. So there's a school for good and a school for evil. And these two girls that everyone knows are the next sort of major students at this school, one who's destined to be a princess named Sophie and one who's destined to be a witch named Agatha, end up going and being switched into the wrong school. So Sophie gets dropped into the school for evil, and Agatha gets dropped into the school for good. And this question of why they were mistaken and put into these wrong schools kind of feeds the next 6 books to come. And so this little simple mistake ends up evolving and spiraling into sort of this Game of Thrones complexity where you have 150 characters, 70 different, you know, kingdoms, and by the end of this very last book, you're looking at a tie into Arthurian legend and the very simple question of who's going to be king of Camelot, and these two girls are your prime candidates. So that's really where we started and where we are now going to end.
Right. And of course, at the heart of that scenario is something that calls into question all the assumptions that we make, that when somebody is pretty and blonde, then they must be good. And if somebody's kind of dark-haired and not so pretty, chances are then they're evil or there's something wrong with them. And, of course, part of what your series is all about is turning those kind of blithe assumptions right on their head.
Yeah, I think it's also the idea that we grow up with a very clear sense of, okay, if you're good, you must look this way in Disney movies, and if you're evil, you must look this way. Whereas if you pay attention and you actually pay attention to what's happening in those stories, it often doesn't line up. Like, you look at The Little Mermaid, and Ariel is obviously the pretty one and Ursula is not, and Ursula is the villain because of it. But it's very clear in that movie that Ariel is the villain because she is the one who's making all the mistakes. She's the disobedient one. She's the one who's fallen in love with somebody without having any clue who he is. She's the one who trespasses on Ursula's property. You know, Ursula at no point really does anything villainous other than get her to sign a contract that Ariel willingly signs. So, you know, this question of our biases, and this feeds into obviously what's happening in the world today, our biases that we don't even question, and we just assume that goodness is something because it looks a certain way, you know, really sort of prompted me to say, well, what if we question all those assumptions? What if you had to empathize with the villain as much as the hero? What would that do? So that's really what this series is about, is questioning these binaries that we're fed, especially kids, and making them think differently, you know? And so whenever people ask me, like, what's the demographic, what kind of people read your books, I'm always like, you know, anybody who wants to ask the right questions about the world, who isn't content being fed information.
One of my questions for you that I didn't get to ask you the first time we talked was that as someone who I believe graduated summa cum laude from Harvard, so obviously you are someone with a really brilliant mind, what kind of challenge is it to take that superb intellect and feed it into this particular kind of genre intended primarily for young readers? I mean, in the sense of keeping things at a certain level where young readers are going to be able to take it in and really appreciate it. Has that come actually pretty naturally for you, or has that been a challenge in and of itself?
It's funny. It's the complete opposite of what you would think, which is that you have to remember that kids and teenagers' brains are much more agile than ours. They can hold more information than an adult brain can because they're at the prime of their learning. It's why, in a way, you know, Harry Potter was such a success because it's infinitely complex, and yet the kids can hold every detail of it in their heads. So if anything, when I write for kids, I have to be almost more ambitious in the scale and scope of things. And you know, I don't really tone anything down. I just tell the story as if I was telling it to an adult, and I really go as far as I can in that direction as to, and I think it's why we've had so many adult fans. I would say at least 30 to 40% of our audience is parents and grandparents who've gotten, you know, sucked into reading it because of their kids. But, you know, I really push for it to be as ambitious and complex and difficult sort of in its shades of gray as possible. The only thing we end up doing at the very end is me and my editor sort of sit down and look at anything that linguistically is too kind of esoteric or complex, and we might simplify a little bit, you know, where the sentence structure might be slightly easier to take, but very little is sort of accounted for kids, because if you look at the old fairy tales from the Grimms and things like that, it was for everybody. It was for all audiences. They did very little to make it kid-friendly. And so I think the reason it's been popular is because I don't make it kid-friendly. I assume kids can keep up, and they do, in my experience.
Clearly. We're speaking with Soman Shenani about his series of books, The School for Good and Evil, and the sixth and final book, One True King, is about to be published. When you began this 7 years ago, did you have this overall structure in mind, that this would be a series of six books, or at some point did you end up having to make that decision? And was that a difficult decision to make?
I think I had a sort of Star Wars structure in mind, this idea of doing it in trilogies. So I knew that the first 3 years would be the years at school, and the second year, 3 years would be the years at Camelot. And theoretically, I could do, you know, more sort of sets of three after. But I think once I finished the second three, I felt like I'd covered so much ground, and the ending was the right ending, that I realized that, you know, it was time to kind of, it was done. There was nowhere else to go, with these characters at least. You know, maybe in the future there's a way to kind of reboot the world and start fresh. But these particular characters, their story had come to an end, you know. And so I think it was time.
Exactly. Explain what sort of the tumultuous heart and soul of this particular book, One True King.
So every book deals with kind of a binary and themes. Like the first book was good and evil. The second book looked at boys and girls and the assumptions that we make about them. Third book was about old and young. The fourth book was about truth and lies. Fifth book about past and present. And then this one's about fate and free will. This idea of what's the balance between how much we have in our control and how much we don't. And so every book kind of uses those poles, like the two binaries and things that we have been fed information about in order to believe, and really makes us question them. So I thought it was a good way to kind of end really on this nature of the question of creativity itself, because even as a writer, how much am I controlling what comes out on the page and how much is just sort of channeled? You know, and so all these things kind of play into the larger scheme of both this book and the series.
I know that early in your creative career, you were more than anything a screenwriter and director. I wonder how much that plays into the work that you have done on The School for Good and Evil. That is, to what extent you have been, in a sense, thinking cinematically right from the start, which, of course, also gives us a chance for you to say something about the film treatment of The School for Good and Evil that we're going to soon be seeing.
I mean, I think it definitely helped in that first one, because I think what set it apart and what made it popular was that the book moved so much faster than other books of its kind at the time. And because it was sort of thought through almost as a cinematic experience, I wrote it almost like I would be writing a movie. And so it moves very quick. And so even the most reluctant readers, you know, were able to sort of sail along with it. And now it's made it easier on the movie side. It's being made into movies by Netflix. And it's being directed by Paul Feig, this brilliant director who did Bridesmaids and Spy and Ghostbusters and A Simple Favor, and the creator, he's the creator of Freaks and Geeks. And it just sort of naturally has a very clear three-act structure already, because that's my training as a screenwriter. And so it's sort of made to be a movie, and there was never any question that it would be able to work as a movie. So I'm looking forward to that as kind of the next part of this journey, is seeing what it looks like when it's brought to screen, and also, you know, having such a talented director in charge of it means I can kind of let go of the reins a little and see what happens.
And for you creatively, what is next?
I'm going to, you know, be involved in the movie as much as I can, but then I'm already working on sort of a standalone project that is completely different from The School for Good and Evil, which will be sort of like a slim little novel. And then, you know, probably taking another bite at a big series. But, you know, right now it's a strange time in the world, and I think it's a good opportunity to kind of step back and think about, all right, well, what's going to have the most impact, and what's going to matter, you know, a year from now, and trying to be ahead, because that's what I think you know, the best writers always are, is looking ahead and trying to be ahead of the curve.
Hmm. Well, in the meantime, you've certainly achieved something really marvelous with The School for Good and Evil. And again, the sixth and final book, One True King, is just out. And you can find out more about this wonderful universe at Ever Never TV, which Soman Shinani oversees on YouTube. Soman Shinani, what a great pleasure it's been to read these books and to speak with you about them. Very best wishes to you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We spend the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show with Tom Engelberger, who is well known for over 40 books he has written for children. But what we're going to be talking about today is a wonderful new adventure for him. He is adapting one of the most popular children's characters in all the world, Geronimo Stilton, into a graphic novel, The Sewer Rat Stink. And this is a professional triumph and a real personal triumph as well, since Tom Engelberger and his family have enjoyed Geronimo Stilton for many, many years. So this has to be a thrilling opportunity for him indeed. Tom Engelberger, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the chance to come on and talk to you and your listeners.
So real quick, for the sake of any listeners who are not acquainted with Geronimo Stilton, just explain what this world is all about and kind of the extent of its popularity.
Right. Some of your listeners may not have heard of him, but their kids probably have. He is super popular worldwide. Geronimo Stilton is a mouse reporter in New Mouse City, and all he really wants to do is sit around his newspaper office and put out his newspaper every day and eat cheese. But it never works out that way. There's always some kind of crazy adventure waiting for him. And in this case, the adventure takes the form of a terrible smell that drives everybody out of town, except for Geronimo and his buddy, a mouse detective.
Right.
And so together they try to solve the mystery of the sewer rat stink.
And I think you hit on what's probably maybe the single most important element that makes him such a wonderful character, the fact that he is kind of a bespectacled bookworm who really is not interested in having wild, madcap adventures, and yet they keep finding him. So he's, in a sense, a very unlikely protagonist, which is probably one of the reasons why we root for him and enjoy him so much.
I think you have hit it on the head there. You have a great understanding of Geronimo. That's exactly what he's all about. He would never go on any of these adventures, and yet there's a whole shelf full of them. He is so much fun, and I think kids really enjoy reading a book about an adult, but they might not enjoy reading about an adult person in the real world, but they love reading about an adult mouse in the mouse world. It opens up the world to them in a fun way where they can sort of get a peek at what adult life is going to be like, with the work responsibilities and social situations, but yet it's still kooky and crazy and full of absolutely over-the-top action.
Hmm. So you and your whole family have been huge fans of Geronimo Stilton and of the dozens and dozens and dozens of books that have been created over the years. I should think that mostly helped you when this opportunity came for you to adapt one of these stories into a graphic novel. Was it also kind of intimidating to suddenly be on the creative end of something that you had yourself enjoyed as a reader?
Yeah, it's really interesting to have this chance. I say it's like going to another kid's house and playing in their sandbox. You go over there, and they've got all these cool toys, and you want to grab them and everything. But sometimes the kid's there going like, wait, don't break my truck, you know. So that's what it's like for me. My job is going to different sandboxes and playing with the toys. And I tell you, it's about the most fun job you could ever have.
Hmm.
But you have to be careful and make sure you follow the rules that each kid has.
Of course, for you, this is also interesting in that you've written all these previous books for children, but this is the first time you have actually created a graphic novel. Talk for a moment about this particular genre and what it felt like to move into it. Has it felt comfortable? Does it feel like a wonderful new home for you?
Well, it really does. I think this could be a turning point for me. For 10 years, I've been sort of known as writing novels for kids. And if for the next 10 years I could write graphic novels for kids, that would be fantastic. This has actually been my dream for so long, to be a comic book artist. And I've always been doing it ever since I was a kid. It's just I had never had the chance to actually publish a graphic novel before. And so this has just been so much fun, and it's a lot of work. I'm not sure I quite realized how much work goes into one of these until I actually sat down to do it. But it's fun. It's absolute joy.
What kinds of things did you think about in terms of making this work effectively as a graphic novel? I mean, thinking about your young readers and what would be most effective for them.
Right. I'm always trying to keep my goal for both my novels and for this graphic novel is to never give a kid a reason to put a book down. Anytime you give a kid a reason to put a book down, they may not pick it back up again. So I try to just keep things absolutely rolling and jam-packed with action and gags and funny business, and I try to keep the sentences short and the chapters short and just keep things rolling. Teachers and educators often talk about a kind of kid called a reluctant reader, and this is maybe a kid who doesn't always get excited about reading the book they're supposed to be reading in class. I try to write books for that kid, for the kid that's reluctant. I'm hoping after they get a peek at mine, they won't be quite as reluctant. They'll jump in and find out how much fun it can be.
I want to take just a minute or so to talk about one thing that I know is important to you, the fact that you are someone with Asperger's, and you do not consider this a hindrance. If anything, you like to think of it as your superpower. Explain how your Asperger's folds into the work that you do as a writer.
Well, absolutely. I use that term superpower to make it clear to kids, to get through to kids quickly, and tell them that if a kid in their class has autism or they have autism, it's not a stop sign. So many people think it means, you know, that's it. This is a terrible thing. And in so many ways, it's a green light. Yes, there are things that I'm not very good at because I'm an autistic adult. But there are other things that I can do that a normal person couldn't or wouldn't do. For instance, illustrating 180 pages about sewer rats. That's something that I'm ready to dive right into and have a great time with. And, of course, my Origami Yoda series, that never would have happened if I was normal. You have to be a little unusual to come up with something like that. And it worked for me. And I just try to get across to kids, they're going to find the thing that works for them. And don't let people tell you that you'll never find it, because there's probably something that they're great at. And if they can find it and put it all together, the sky's the limit.
Hmm. By the way, you are married to an acclaimed graphic novelist, Cece Bell. And I suspect that probably came in handy as you were crafting your first graphic novel.
Oh, man. You know, it's funny. Not only am I not the best artist in the world, I'm not even the best artist in this house. Cece is, she wrote a graphic novel memoir that was the first book, the first graphic novel to ever win the Newbery Honor from the American Library Association. And then she went on to win the Eisner Award from the comic book industry. So she got it from, she got honored from both directions on that one, and I'll never catch up with her. She's way ahead of me, but she is a huge inspiration to me every day.
Well, you're off to a great start with The Sewer Rat Stink, which is Geronimo Stilton, the graphic novel. Tom Engelberger, congratulations on this great honor, and best wishes to you as you continue to give the world wonderful books for children.
Hey, thank you very much. I sure appreciate that.
Tomorrow, it will be the monthly visit of Nan Calvert to the morning show.